Our topic for tonight is the continuation of the Yom Kippur War and the lead up to the election after the war. So we left off last time on the third day of Milchemet Yom Kippurim on October 8th, which was a very bad day in the history of the IDF, the Monday of the war. And I'm not going to discuss all the military battles. I want to focus on political questions that emerged during the course of the conflict. One of those was whether or not to bomb Damascus. So at first, Golda Meir rejected the idea, but her military advisor, Minister Without Portfolio, Yisrael Galili, whom she trusted implicitly, said, it may be unpalatable, but you got to do it. You got to bomb Damascus. Well, so the question is, to what end? To what extent and for what purpose? Basically, there was the same purpose as the Doolittle raids over Tokyo. In other words, it had to be some kind of a moral victory, a boost of morale, by saying we could hit the other guy while they're bludgeoning us. Of course, the trouble is they have SAM missile batteries that are going to prevent the Air Force from getting into their targets. So there had to be a very sophisticated flight pattern over the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, going up and down and complicated maneuvers. And ultimately, little damage was done, other than to the electricity grid. So Damascus did suffer some blackouts during the course of the war. But this was not done to damage in any serious way military targets. It was psychologically important, but that's about it. Further bombing of Damascus later in the war, when it would have been possible after the SAM batteries had been disabled, was contemplated, but it was canceled over fear of two things. One, Soviet intervention, and secondly, that the Syrians might bomb Israeli cities, which never happened in the course of the war. You know, the coastal cities of Tel Aviv was never hit, but you never know what could happen if you hit Damascus. Okay. Another question that came up was Israel's use of nuclear weapons, and I mentioned only from the perspective of the Israeli side of the coin, the use of extraordinary measures against the Arab states and how it was suggested. Israel went on high nuclear alert, but then nothing came of it. From the Arab point of view, what was their thinking about Israel's nuclear arsenal? So Sadat was aware of Israel's nuclear capabilities, but he didn't fear them. And why didn't he fear them? Because Sadat had absolutely no intention of invading Israel. This was going to be simply a battle in the Sinai, which is Egyptian territory, and it's going to stay 100 miles away from the real Israeli border. So Israel's not going to have justification to engage in reckless doomsday scenarios of using nuclear weapons. As for the Syrians, however, where the border is right there, and they're very close, that logic obviously wouldn't apply, but we don't know the extent to which Assad was familiar with Israel's nuclear arsenal. Okay.
The premise of Golda's balcony,
yeah,
where she was contemplating it.
It was contemplated, but very briefly, and it was dismissed very quickly. All right.
Would they have contemplated it without the agreement of the United States?
I don't know. It's hard for me to say. So later in the first week of the war, the Golan counterattack happened, and it was wildly successful. Of course, it was together with horrible casualties, and many, many IDF soldiers lost their lives in the process. But
in the counterattack?
In the counterattack, yeah. Everything was bloody. Even the first few days, the Syrian strike was devastating. The counterattack was difficult, but was very successful, and very rapid at that. So the question is, when IDF forces got to the Purple Line, what do they do next? The Purple Line was the post-1967 border, and the option, of course, is to stop, and everything goes to status quo ante, or you press forward. And this is a political question that the military had to get a guidance from the government. So what were the arguments in favor of pursuing this war further in the north, and what are the arguments in favor of stopping at the old line? So the arguments in favor of pushing forward, against pushing forward, stopping, number one, the ability to transfer troops and materiel from the northern front to the southern front where it's desperately needed. That if the northern war is over, and there's no intention to pursue it any further for territorial gain, you can transfer stuff down south. Reason number two, the Purple Line was a reasonably good defensive line with physical obstacles as barriers along the way. And this was, you know, a reasonable place to stop It's a good posture. And number three, any random line along the road to Damascus where they might have to stop due to an imposed ceasefire would invariably be less of a defensive line than the old purple line was. So these are all arguments against doing anything further.
What? Russia.
Huh? Russia. Well, so antagonizing Russia is, of course, another reason maybe to stop, although Lavdavka to stop right there. You wait until the Russians get really angry and then impose a ceasefire and then you stop. So that is not something that was brought up in reference to the northern part of the war. In the south, however, the issue of casualties would be brought up by Ariel Sharon in his objection to what we'll see as a secondary assault on the Missouri, which was near the Chinese farm, names that might not be familiar to you, but we'll discuss soon enough. So the casualties are an issue in the south, not so much discussed in the north. Okay, what about pushing forward? Why do it? Number one, it's an opportunity to knock Syria out of the war completely and to devastate them and make sure that they have no war-making capabilities. Number two, you can gain some territory so as to compensate for the loss of territory elsewhere, namely in the Sinai. If you're going to lose here, at least win something here. Thirdly, taking land specifically against Syria would arguably be a necessary bargaining chip to secure the return of POWs, who were a considerable number being held captive by Syria.
How were they treated in retrospect?
Not very well.
It
depends. In the case of Egypt, some were executed. In certain instances, Egypt didn't take POWs. They just killed people. In other cases, they did take POWs, and they were treated reasonably well, actually better than under the Syrians.
I think we should also mention that the Israelis also killed their Egyptian prisoners. And they couldn't move with them. They shot.
So that did happen on certain occasions.
They asked for volunteers to do it. They weren't ordered to kill, but they shot them.
What happened more often, though, was that people were just sent off into the desert where they might have died without food or water. So ultimately, the decision was made to attack Syria. This did not go very far. It made certain progress to the northeasterly direction, getting closer and closer to Damascus, but 25 miles to 30 miles removed, and then it stopped. Why? Because of an Iraqi intervention. The Iraqi intervention on the southern Golan neutralized Israel's ability to push further north and east.
But if they went into Damascus, they would have a tremendous amount of refugees.
Okay, so there never really was a plan. Well, there was a plan, actually, to conquer Damascus, but it was like one of these pie-in-the-sky, keep-it-in-the-vault, never-to-touch-it plans that the military comes up with. The goal was not to actually get to Damascus so much as to scare the Syrian regime and the Syrian population by getting close enough that the suburbs and even outer neighborhoods of the capital city were within artillery range. Okay, so
Quneitra was
retaken and ultimately given away. So by October 13th, the war in the north was largely finished, other than for improving positions in the so-called enclave, which was the term used to describe Israeli occupation of beyond the Purple Line territories, and the retaking of Mount Hermon. The retaking of Hermon was a big deal because Hermon was lost very early in the war, and it was an embarrassing loss that the eyes and ears of the Golan were lost so quickly. Now let's discuss the American airlift. Much has been made of the American airlift, but as a political matter and even as a military matter, of what relevance was it? So, Secretary of Defense Schlesinger, who was, from what I could tell, the son of a Meshumad.
Son of
a Meshumad.
What's Meshumad?
An apostate. So, he was opposed to the airlift, or at least any substantial airlift, because he felt that America had no moral obligation to help Israel hold on to Arab territories, notably the Golan and the Sinai, and that since the war was not on Israel proper, and it wasn't going to be on Israel proper, therefore no need to do any much of an airlift. Kissinger disagreed and said we have to make sure that our client beats the Soviet client and our weapons beat Soviet weapons. He also wanted Israel to win, but win only ever so slightly, meaning have it be close to a tie with Israel squeaking out a nail-biter of a victory, so that the political process after the war could be stage-managed by Kissinger himself without Soviet meddling or interference. The airlift was approved by Nixon on the 13th. The plane started landing on October 14th. Was this material used in the course of the war? And the answer is, for the most part, no. Israel actually had a greater stockpile of weaponry and ammunition than it thought it did. There was a miscommunication. There were supplies that were available that were concealed, that were discovered. So what did the airlift accomplish?
Planes.
So even planes, to a great extent, were not introduced into the battle, and certainly not so many tanks. But what happened was, Israel had a limited supply and did not want to go down to empty, to zero. So whenever you're getting close to zero, you conserve your resources. By conserving your resources, it means they're not available for fighting, but you need them for fighting. The airlift allowed the use of everything that Israel already had, because now there's another stockpile behind the scenes waiting for an emergency. So yes, some planes were used, but a lot of them weren't, and certainly a lot of the tanks were not used. But it was relevant insofar as their existing material was able to be put forth to the battlefield without hesitation.
Can you address the refueling plane issue?
So Portugal was pressured into allowing refueling in the Azores and overflights, and the other Europeans were not cooperative.
The United States asked them, and they said no.
They said no. Yeah.
Which country said no?
Several European Union countries. I'm not sure exactly which ones, but I'm assuming France, and
that's a fair assumption.
I'm not sure who else, but for sure France. No, no. Okay, so on October 9th, a reconnaissance mission getting close to the canal discovered that there was a seam about 2 miles wide between the Third Army and the Second Army of the Egyptians. The Third Army was to the south, the Second Army was to the north. There's a gap in between them, just north of the lake, right on the edge of the canal. And this was going to be the key to victory, getting across the canal to Africa by running right through this hole. But it's a very risky proposition. Because how do you get across? You need bridges. And how do you lay down the bridges? You're going to need to have a lot of men and material and weaponry bursting through that narrow seam. It's going to be necessary to widen it, which will mean bitter warfare and the Battle of the Chinese Farm. But Israel is reluctant to do that at first because there is a significant presence of Egyptian armor on the west side of the canal. So there needs to be some movement out of their position by the Egyptians to make this at all feasible. Well, fortunately for Israel, late in the day on October 11th, they find out that the Egyptians plan on having a cross-canal thrust to push towards the middle of the Sinai, where there'll be a massive tank battle, and the IDF is confident that they'll win, and in fact they do win. October 14th is a horrible day for the Egyptians and a great day for Israel. The Egyptians lost like 300 tanks in one day. It was a big success for the IDF. So the canal crossing was delayed until that could happen. But who is pushing hard for an immediate crossing of the canal? Ariel Sharon. So Sharon is angry at the rest of the general staff, thinking that their point of view is that this is the last battle of the Warsaw Ghetto, that doom and gloom. Sharon, when he comes to the front, has a very optimistic approach and says, "We can do this. We can push across and we can win big." His attitude was not shared by everybody, and in hindsight, it was justified to have that kind of attitude because it really was a big success. Yet even when the October 14th battle was over, there was a sense that the meal was half eaten, that even more Egyptian armor could have been destroyed, and maybe even more has to be done in the days to follow. But at least by that point, Moshe Dayan, the defense minister, who had been reluctant about a canal crossing, was now an enthusiast. Beforehand, what Dayan wanted to do really was to push towards Damascus and to try to have this Soviet Union impose a ceasefire on all the parties because Damascus was threatened. When that didn't work out, the canal is a nice alternative. Okay, so then the question is, when you do the crossing of the canal, how much stuff and how many men are going to cross in the early wave? Because you're going to go on pontoon bridges and gilloas, which are basically recycled junk. It wasn't going to be a stable bridge at first. So Sharon wanted as much as 200 tanks. And Dayan said, no, you can't do that. And Bar-Lev said no, and Elazar said no. What's the danger? The danger is you put too many people on the other side, and then you can't get back because there's no road to get back. So it's a very risky proposition, but it's maybe something that's worthwhile. Ultimately, it was not done. It was only a small group who crossed the canal at first, with everyone else waiting for the roller bridge, which was laid out on October 17th, a few days later. Israel built it. Israel built it over the stretch of a few years. It was 200 yards long on these wheels, and it was pushed from a 5-mile spot away from the canal. It was supposed to be moved only 2 miles, but because of the fighting, they had to keep it 5 miles away and then drive it over like a half a day, the 5 miles, till it got to the water. No, this was done during the war. During the war, yeah.
No, when they encircled the army, the Egyptian army,
yeah,
on the west side, they were able to evacuate eventually through that.
Yes. It was up for a while.
Did they get permission from the United States to do this?
No.
The United States have knowledge of
this? No. And in fact, I'll explain who knew and who didn't know. It's shocking. Who didn't know? All right. Well, just before, not until after it happened. Not until after it happened. Okay. So, the Battle of Chinese Farm. Why was it called the Chinese Farm? Because when Israel got to the western reaches of the Sinai in 1967, they discovered agricultural outposts and Japanese writing on the certain crates. Because there were the Egyptians and the Japanese had some sort of collaborative venture there. But nobody knew that this was Japanese, so they thought it was Chinese. So they called it the Chinese Farm, and that's how the name stuck. This was a bloody battle. This is a horrible battle, probably the worst fighting of the war. It was chaos. It was hand-to-hand, tank-to-tank at point-blank range. Everybody suffered terribly, but Israel basically won the battle and was able to widen the bridgehead, enabling people to cross.
This was all under Sharon's command?
This was under Sharon's command, but Sharon was not allowed to cross. He was supposed to maintain a presence on the east side, widen the corridor to the best of his ability. The crossing was his recommendation, and eventually he'll personally do it. But the credit for the crossing is not given to him because he was with mop-up jobs on the east side of the canal. And he thought that was a political stunt pulled by Bar-Lev because they're opposing parties. Sharon is the Likud, is the founder of the Likud party, and was running the Likud campaign before the war broke out. Chaim Bar-Lev was Minister of Commerce and a labor politician, and Bar-Lev is now Sharon's boss as the Southern Front commander. And Sharon accused Bar-Lev and the others of stealing all the glory away from him when this was supposed to be his moment to shine, and it was all for politics. Bar-Lev would deny that.
So the story that he was in the first tank that went across, that's
a pot. He was not the first. He would go back and forth several times between the 17th and the 22nd, when the war sort of comes to a bit of an end. And his troops do cross, but not in the first wave. It was not his glory. Okay. So when the crossing happened, at least to a limited extent on Tuesday the 16th, Golda made a speech in the Knesset announcing that the IDF is operating on the west side of the canal. That was news to a lot of people. It was even news to Anwar Sadat.
Oh my God.
He didn't know. And even after she said it, and Diane was furious that she spilled the beans because he didn't want her to, it was a blunder on her part. She wasn't supposed to say anything. Even after she said it, Sadat didn't believe it was true. He thought it was psychological warfare, the likes of which the Arabs pulled against the Israelis in 1967, saying we downed the 5,000 planes, you know, that we've destroyed the Israel Air Force. He thought it was all a big bluff and a lie. In fact, it was the truth. Okay? So,
isn't there an empirical way of knowing?
Yes, if you have so the Americans had satellite overflights, and they had data shortly after it happened. They didn't have advanced knowledge, but they had real knowledge after it happened. Okay, so let's talk about Sharon for a little bit here. Sharon, who was managing the Likud campaign, would occasionally call Menachem Begin from the war zone to complain about the course of the battle. Remember, Sharon had been Southern Front commander, and now is not. Now he's somebody else's underling, and he's got several layers of command above him, and he doesn't always agree with what they're doing. So he calls the political class, Begin, to say, these guys are inept, they don't know what they're talking about. His reporting from the field was spotty and sometimes inaccurate and sometimes intentionally inaccurate because he wanted to conceal what was going on so he could do things the way he wanted to do them. Others believed he was angling for personal glory. He gave positive interviews to reporters from the field, something which was out of character for the IDF at the time, but he wanted to show all is well and I'm the winner. I'm winning. Some say the head bandage was bogus.
I found his picture.
So, I mean, that's like saying the eye patch was bogus on Diane or the thing on Gorbachev's head. I don't know.
What on that bandage?
So, or was it Kurt Schilling's sock? I don't know. I mean, but they say that he was playing to the cameras. And when the war was going well and the crossing was happening, he was distributing oranges, throwing oranges from his armored personnel carrier to soldiers passing through. And people said when he was younger, he never did this. This was the hallmark of a political general, not a general's general. Okay, so there was a meeting on October 17th, Wednesday, at the Southern Front headquarters, where Bar-Lev was criticizing Sharon for not doing his job properly, for not widening the corridor for IDF troops sufficiently. And Sharon in his memoir said, I wanted to slap Bar-Lev across the face. He didn't, but he wanted to. Okay. So, on the 17th, the bridge was built, the sturdier bridge. Diane went for a visit to Africa, and he came back that night to Tel Aviv, to Golda, and she said, you were in Africa? And he said, yes. And Diane said to her, by tomorrow, half the IDF will be in Africa. So things were going reasonably well. It was a series of 45 fortifications all along the canal that were designed to prevent an Egyptian crossing. They existed for about 4 years prior to the Yom Kippur War. They were built in 69-70 during the War of Attrition. And Israel built them. That's why they're called the Bar-Lev Line, for Chaim Bar-Lev, who was the chief of staff at the time. It was an interesting idea, but it was probably not the best idea. And in hindsight, holding on to them cost a lot of lives, maybe needlessly. Okay, so...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What was that?
I'm sorry.
Okay, all right, don't worry about it. So, what happens after the IDF crosses to the western side? So there are two things that need to happen. Actually, three. One is a push towards Cairo. Not with any intent of getting to Cairo, but just threatening. The closer you get, the more nervous the Egyptian population, the Egyptian high command is. Secondly, you want to take positions all along the western side of the canal and plant the Israeli flag as a psychological measure to scare the Egyptians who are on the eastern side of the canal. So now the Israelis are on the Egyptian side, the Egyptians are on the Israeli side. But it's very intimidating for an Egyptian soldier on the eastern side of the canal to now see his former positions being occupied by the Israelis. And lastly, to surround the Third Army and cut them off, which would require delicate maneuvering ahead of an internationally imposed ceasefire. And so the fate of the war was not going to be so much in the hands of the soldiers, so much as it would be in the hands of the likes of Henry Kissinger. And so Henry goes to Moscow for consultation, but he buys time. He tells his Soviet interlocutors, I won't discuss anything with you until I get a full night's sleep at the hotel. that buys an extra 12 hours. In the meantime, so Kissinger wanted additional conquest in the north against the Syrians, and he wanted further conquest in on the western side of the canal by the Israelis. What he did not want was the destruction of the Egyptian army on the eastern side of the canal. He wants them stranded but alive as a negotiating situation.
Was this to apply pressure to the Russians?
It was to keep the Russians out altogether. That's the real goal.
Can you comment on let them bleed?
So the idea of letting them bleed is that if Israel wins without suffering too much, without enduring heavy casualties, then their triumphalist attitude, which existed since the Six-Day War, would remain intact. It's the fact that Israel suffered a heavy dose of casualties, you know, thrice the level of the Vietnam War, and not in the span of a decade, but in the span of 3 weeks, that led Israel to psychologically have a different approach than was the case in 67 through 72 or 73. I don't know if in so many words, but also Lashon, but yes, effectively yes. Okay, so on the night of October 21st, 22nd, the IDF takes the Hermon, both the Israeli peak and even the Syrian peak of the Hermon. So there is gain, territorial gain, beyond the purple line. Kissinger does his best to give Israel some more time, but at 6:52 p.m. on October 22nd, the war is supposed to be over. There's going to be a ceasefire. The Egyptians fire Scud missiles just moments before the ceasefire takes effect, knowing that Israel will not have time to respond. So they fire off a few Scuds at the last second of the war. But would that really be the last second of the war? And the answer is no. The ceasefire would not hold. There'd be violations on both sides, and Israel would surround the Egyptian Third Army after the ceasefire was supposed to have held. So it was an illegitimate encirclement of the Egyptians, which means that the Russians are going to get angry, they're going to threaten nuclear war, they're going to threaten to invade Israel, all sorts of threats are going to be imposed, and the world was on the brink of a big crisis, a superpower crisis. But it was basically averted. The Soviets stepped down, you know, they calmed down and did not get involved. So you have Kosygin and Brezhnev are the big bosses. So the Russians do call, however, and even the Americans call for the Gromyko was around forever. Forever and ever.
Andrei
Gromyko. He did one good thing in his life. 1947, he called for the creation of Israel.
Yes.
That's his one big mitzvah. So the Third Army of the Egyptians, which had about between 25 and 30,000 men, needed supplies, water, food, medicine, something. What is Israel willing to allow? Will they allow non-military supplies? Will they allow nothing? Will they starve them out? Will they butcher them all? What's going to happen here? So there's tremendous pressure being brought against Golda Meir's government to allow for the supply of non-military stuff, of essential food and water and the like, as part of a ceasefire arrangement.
Pressure
from the Americans. And ultimately the Golda Meir administration agrees to this. Some of the soldiers were not happy about it, but it was agreed to. The last battle of the war was the battle for Suez City, which was an abysmal failure, and Israel lost 80 men, and nothing was accomplished. It was terrible. October 24th. That was the last significant battle. Another battle which never happened was the second battle for Missouri, which was near the Chinese farm, where General Gonen and General Barlev ordered Sharon to attack again, and he refused. And he got into a little trouble for that, but Dayan ultimately rescinded the order. So although he could have gotten in trouble, it amounted to nothing. But it was just another instance of Sharon acting on his own accord and not following the higher ups in the chain of command.
What was the military goal?
Goal of that was to widen the corridor to get across to the other side, but it was a lost cause because there was insufficient forces for Missouri to be conquered. After the Battle of the Chinese Farm, Israel had very little left to work with. I mean, there was horrible casualties the previous few days. So At kilometer 101 on the Suez Cairo Road, you have the talks between the Egyptians and the Israelis. The first handshake happens on October 28th, and Golda visits the front on October 29th. When she comes to the front, what does she hear? Arik Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. So the soldiery, they like Ariel Sharon. He's the greatest hero. Golda, not so much. So the soldiers gather around. Golda sits in a chair, and Dayan is next to her, and Elazar is next to him, and they're asking questions, and the questions are coming in and not so comfortable. How could we were caught off guard? Why did this happen? How were we so unprepared? And this is foreshadowing what's going to happen in the Knesset and the wider public sphere in the months ahead. So on November 11th, the Kilometer 101 agreement was signed, and later on January 18th, 1974, the Sinai 1 agreement was signed. What was in this agreement? Basically, Israel pulls out of the west side of the canal, Israel leaves Africa, Israel pulls about 20 miles away from the canal, the Egyptians have a demilitarized area on the east side of the canal, so that their armies are no longer encircled and in danger, and the canals reopened for shipping, for international commerce, and the canal cities are repopulated with Egyptian civilians. What's the relevance of that? You don't typically go to war and to endanger your own civilians. So the repopulating of the canal cities was a very important concession that the Egyptians gave the Israelis as a sort of a guarantee that this is not going to take place again. The answer to that question would be yes, after the peace treaty, not so before the peace treaty.
With ships carrying Israeli goods,
under foreign flag, I believe they could. I believe they could. I believe they could, and that would happen when the canal reopened in the spring of 75. It took over a year for them to reopen because they had to clean it up. There were many submerged ships that were blocking the way. There was also the Yellow Fleet, which was about seven ships that were stuck in the canal, not sunken ships, but actual floating ships that from the Six-Day War had been stuck there. The crew had been there for years. Like a guy gets stuck in the airport for a long time,
Why were they stuck there? Because
they couldn't.
The
canal was blocked, and the companies didn't want to scuttle their ships. They were worth millions of dollars, so they're just stuck until it could reopen for 7 years. Yeah, there's a movie about it. I never saw it, but there's
They brought
a new crew. The international community, the people weren't stuck there forever. I'm exaggerating, but the boats were there for 7 years. Okay, so. The Knesset. David Elazar shows up to the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee and says, the failure was that we didn't mobilize in time. Dayan disagrees and says the whole concept behind the war, or behind IDF thinking about how there wasn't going to be a war, was flawed. The Knesset Committee asks the Defense Minister, do you anticipate another flare-up? Meaning, is this agreement of November 11th going to hold, or is it going to explode in our face and we're going to have more conflict? To which Dayan responded, I would welcome a renewal of hostilities. Our current lines are unsustainable. So, now that didn't happen. But you could understand why he said it. The presence of Israeli forces in Africa with a very narrow corridor to get there, with Egyptians on the east side of the canal, and Israel battered and bruised after having lost so many men and stuff, it was not a good situation. It would have been better if they could improve it by totally wiping out the Egyptian forces in the Sinai. But it never came to pass. Never came to pass. Okay.
When was the Third Army
encircled? Between the time that the encirclement happens and when they get resupplied, about 2 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
But comment if Dayan really said Golda is a Khurban by extension?
She did. He did. He not Khurban, but it's in danger. It's Bisakana. So...
When did you have to evacuate?
Oh, much later, 1982. So let's now talk about the election, because there was an election scheduled for October 24th that didn't happen. It was wartime. It was postponed until December 31st. And the political propaganda in advance of this election was relatively muted compared to in prior cycles. The people were mourning their dead. They were licking their wounds. There wasn't this intense political fervor for nasty electioneering. That's not to say that there was none. There was some. But it wasn't as was the case in 65 or 61 when things were really nasty. Menachem Begin refrained from criticizing Golda Meir so long as the war was ongoing. But as soon as the fighting stopped, he accused her of being frivolously unprepared. The justice minister, Yaakov Shimshon Shapira, accused Dayan of being a major failings, a big blunderer. Dayan offered to resign, but he was rebuffed. You can't resign, so says Golda. Yaakov Chazan of the Mapam, which is part of the alignment, accused Shapira, the justice minister, of committing libel against Dayan. How dare you accuse him of call him a murderer or incompetent? He's our leader, Moshe Dayan. So ultimately, Shapira had to resign as justice minister for calling out Dayan for being a failure. So sometimes the guy who deserves to go down doesn't go down right away. Somebody else takes the fall. Menachem Begin called for Golda to resign because of criminal negligence. Why don't you call up the reserves? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? So a commission was appointed under the auspices of Shimon Agranat, who was the chief justice of the Supreme Court. It also included two former chiefs of staff, Yigal Yadin and Chaim Laskov, and they're going to interview everybody and sit for depositions and eventually issue a report. But that report is not going to be ready till 4 months after the election, in April. December, no one really knows what the government commission is going to say. So people go to the polls knowing that the war was pretty bad, but not knowing who they necessarily want to blame. So,
but the people would definitely have in their mind who's to blame without having an official report.
That's true. That is definitely true. So let's now go to some of the propaganda. Let's take a look at Emmet, the alignment. So the alignment has the... Well, actually, before we go to the alignment, let's discuss the Likud, because the Likud is going to get feisty and is going to say that the existing government has got to go. So it says like this. So a call to all citizens of Israel, irrespective of your political philosophy or of your background, whatever it is. So it says the following. In the elections for the 8th Knesset, which is 1973, we want you to give us the opportunity to make a nationalist government that will act in accordance with our political defense situation. Okay? The current administration, Ashir Shultonah HaMemushach, Midai, which has been way too long. They've been in charge for 25 years. It's enough. It's enough already with the labor alignment. Hevi l'mashber amok has brought us to deep crisis. B'shetach hachevrati at the social level, hamusari the moral level, hameshaki and the economic level, nichshala kishlon chamur biyoter af b'shmirat b'tchono shlomo shel ha'am. And even in the matter of basic national defense, they have failed. In other words, we have disagreed with the left side of the aisle, we the right side of the aisle, on social issues and economic issues for the last quarter century. And everybody knows our position, everybody knows their position, and there are people who like our position, there are people who like their position. But the one thing the left side of the aisle had going for them was they could always say, we were the stewards of the country and we did a darn good job of it. At least we kept you safe. Well, you know what? Now they can't say that anymore. So all they had going for them has been blown up to smithereens. So therefore, you got to vote for us. What are the four principles of the Likud platform? So it says like this. Aleph, one. Chiyuv masau matan yashir beviidat shalom imidinot Arab al chozei shalom. Direct face-to-face negotiations with the Arab states over the prospect of peace. Two. Shlilat nesigot we reject any withdrawals which will endanger our security and our peace. In other words, we're going to be very opposed to withdrawals, bichlal, in general, because they're always going to endanger our security and peace. Three, we reserve the right, the historic right of the Jews to Eretz Yisrael and to real security and real peace. Four, גיוס העם היהודי וידידי ישראל ברחבי תבל, במיוחד בארצות הברית, כדי למנוע לחץ, ולדחות לחץ. So we call upon all of our friends around the world, Jews and non-Jews alike, who are friends of Israel, to prevent foreign governments from imposing lachatz. What's lachatz?
Pressure,
political pressure upon the Israelis to make all sorts of concessions. So we are going to have a robust foreign policy that's going to find friends, real friends, that will push off whatever pressure is coming from the enemies or even neutral parties. That's the Likud approach. So there is the movement for greater Israel, and the movement for greater Israel is a constituent element of the Likud. What is the Likud? The Likud was Gachal. What was Gachal? Gachal was the Chirut party and the liberals. So it's Chirut liberals is one Gachal. Then you had the Free Center, which was a breakaway from Gachal that came back into the fold. Then you had the Nationalist, which was Ben-Gurion's, the residual elements of Ben-Gurion's party. And lastly, the Land of Israel movement, the Greater Israel movement. All those groups came together in 1973 under Ariel Sharon to form the Likud, with Chirut as the main block, with the number one person in the party being Menachem Begin. Okay.
Now that ad essentially talks about the politics and the fighting,
yeah,
the war. They did mention a little bit of the economics. What was the economic situation?
Bad. There was the cost of living was going up and salaries were not. And the war made things a lot worse, because you had people conscripted for long periods of time. So whereas the economy had been very good in the late 60s or to early 70s, the economy turned bad around 72, 73, and it was rough going of it at that time.
Inflation
was very, very bad. I mean, not like the 1980s levels. That was already hyperinflation, but still, it was pretty bad in the early 70s. Okay, now we have another ad, which was not put out by the Likud per se, but was saying the sorts of things that Likud propagandists would want people to think. Sadat v'Arafat mitpalalim l'nitzachon ha'ma'arach v'v'chirot. That Anwar Sadat and Yasser Arafat are davening for the alignment, the labor alignment, to win the elections. Okay, now that's not a nice thing to say, but all right. What's the subtitle? Lo mishum shehamarachu partner the shalom. The reason why Sadat and Arafat are praying for a labor victory is not because the labor alignment is a partner for peace with them, the Arabs, because after all, the Arabs want chisul Yisrael, the destruction of Israel. But rather, it's because only the alignment will pull back to insecure Israeli borders and result in Tilim missiles 15 kilometers from Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Netanya. So basically, this is a right-wing approach of we cannot have any territorial withdrawal because it'll necessarily endanger our security. Okay, what about labor? What is labor claiming? What is their platform here? So, we get labor. So this was an ad that was sent to students at the university. It says, on the 31st of December, Ata koveya et gorala medina goralcha. You're going to figure out or establish the destiny of the country, your destiny. Ata machria, you will decide, ben sikui leheskem shalom mishcheinenu, about the possibility of a peace agreement with our neighbors, leben derech hamovila al milchama bilti poseket, never-ending war. So the labor victory means possibility of peace. A Likud victory means never-ending war. Ben hemshech medinut shel yedidut hadukai matzot habrit. Our approach, labor approach, is good relations with the United States. Ben derecha misakenet yedidut zu. And the Likud approach is fanaticism that's going to endanger the relations with the Americans. And so on and so forth. And our approach is ofi yehudi shel Yisrael. We will preserve the Jewish character of the state of Israel. And what is the Likud approach? L'sapech uchlusia aravit rabat mamadim. That the Likud wants to incorporate a tremendous number of Arabs into the state of Israel. How so? By largely annexing the West Bank. Okay, so if you want to have a Jewish Israel, you got to vote for Labor. If you want to have a half Arab Israel, you got to vote for Likud. So this and a few other points that they had to make. What do we see here? That the Likud is being cast in the image of an extreme radical party, whereas the Likud itself would like to portray its image as we're reasonable, and the laborites are weak-kneed and going to endanger everybody's security. They did already, and they'll do it again by reckless peace endeavors. Okay, which point of view is more compelling? What do you think the voters are going to go for?
Well, Labor what?
That's true. But why did they win? Not necessarily because those messages were all that convincing.
They were sick and tired of war.
Okay.
And the Likud kind of promised continuous war.
The Likud was promising continuous war, without a doubt.
Why? The Likud had the first one. They wanted to have direct negotiations.
Okay, but people didn't really believe that. They really didn't. Okay, now let's go to some of the other parties that. Because of 25 years of Menachem Begin's bellicose rhetoric. Yeah. Okay. So let's now go to some other parties that. Yeah. At that time, yes. No, in 1996, Benjamin Netanyahu, in his first go-around as prime minister, was able to have a jingle, Osim Shalom Batuach, that was his jingle, right. And people fell for it.
You know, when Begin...
Okay, but Begin...
People thought it was going to be...
They thought the world was going to come to an end.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so let's now go to the religious parties, because here we get something very interesting. Who moved to Israel in 1971?
Mayor Kahana.
Mayor Kahana, bingo. All right, I gave you one guess and you got it right.
I know it.
All right.
Because he bought his appliances in my father's store.
Good. Okay. So.
And he was the only one to move to Israel. Right?
So, in 1973, the National Religious Party, no longer under the auspices of Zerach Wahavdig and Chaim Moshe Shapira, was no longer a dovish party, the close, reliable ally of the labor alignment. Now, what is the Mafdal? The Mafdal says it all in a little headline here. B'chatimat Heskemi Mitnachalei Chevron, there's an agreement with the settlers in Chevron. Burg, Joseph Burg, the head of the Mafdal, Hitchayev B'shem Mafdal Lagshim Rayon Shel Shlemut Haaretz, that the NRP agrees to actualize the concept of the totality of Eretz Yisrael. So that's territorial maximalism on the West Bank and Gaza. And maybe the Golan too. That means that the Labor no longer has a reliable party of 10 to 12 seats, the third largest party in the Knesset, that will go along with its agenda of peaceful negotiations with the Arabs over the trade of territory. So we'll see next week, that's going to be a big problem for Golda Meir and then later for Yitzhak Rabin and her successor in forming a coalition. But putting that aside, the issue is, how will the NRP distinguish itself from Kach, the JDL, the Kahanists? So Kach is running ads left and right and trying to rile up the crowd of the national religious audience and even not so religious audience, just ultra-nationalists saying, vote for me. We'll, you know, keep everybody safe and we'll stick it to the Arabs. Well, an ad came out by the NRP. Says Tzair Dati, Kahana Molich Otcha Sholel, that Kahana is leading you down a very negative and destructive path. Kahana Talush Memetzut Amitit, Kahana is divorced from the living reality of Israel. Meaning he's an American who showed up 2 seconds ago, doesn't really know what's going on. He's just an extremist who's saying the most, a carpetbagger, who's saying the most incendiary possible thing, and he's hoping to win votes that way. So Kahana Toveya, in quotation marks, Bekesef, he's drowning in money, American money. Umafzitz Otanu B'modaot. What does that mean? Mafzitz Otanu. He's bombing us with political pronouncements and ads and the like and posters. So the Mafzitz part harks back to what? When the JDL killed somebody in New York. At the offices of the Russian orchestra, was it a ballet?
No.
It was something, some cultural entity, and the woman who died was a Jew. Okay, so who is Mia Takahana? Who are you? How many settlements did you establish? How many yeshivas did you establish? What have you done for Eretz Yisrael? Nothing. We, the real Israelis, the real national religious, have done all the things that you wish you could have done. So, huh? That's a good question. I would imagine people in New York, friends of his from the 60s, who had some money in their pockets and gave him cash. Okay. So, you have this intramural battle among the national religious. But let's go to other elements within the population. What about the Black Panthers. A few weeks ago, I mentioned the Black Panthers. So they ran an ad, and it was it's a very nice ad, actually, if I might say so myself. In nice, pretty script, cursive Hebrew letters, it says, "Anu mazkirim uvdot." We remember the facts. Bahadchala, in the beginning, karu lahem mishpachot merubot iladim. In the old days of Israel, they used to refer to large families as families with a lot of children, merubot iladim. Acharekein shaluvai. Then they asked, "Why do you have so many kids?" Meaning you, the indigent Moroccan Jews who live in the Musrara and the other poor neighborhoods, why are you having so many kids? Ben-Gurion, who wanted every Jewish family to have four or five kids, now all of a sudden, by 1970, they said to the poor Moroccans, how come you're having 8, 9 children? You could have one or two, it's enough. You can't afford to have so many children. So, mi amar lahem lasot kol kach harbe yiladim? Who told you to use contraception? Achirim asu tova, v'karu lahem bruchot yiladim. Others were nicer about it and said, bruchot yiladim, you're blessed with a lot of children. Yom Hadin, but when it came to the Day of Judgment, and that this is a play on words, Yom Hadin meaning Yom Kippur, the Yom Kippur War, he melchemet Yom Kippurim, lo shalu me'efo kama v'lama. Nobody asked the Moroccan soldiers, the 18, 19-year-old kids who were being sent out to the war, how many brothers and sisters do you have? The IDF was just happy to have manpower. And they were no longer bad-mouthing the poor Sephardim for having too large of a family. Kulam higiu lachazit v'hadfu begufam biyachad im kol chayle Yisrael. They all showed up to the front and with their bodies pushed forward against the enemy. Kisha chazru mechazit mi yidag lahem. But when they get back from the front, who's going to worry about them? Anachnu, we'll worry about them. Hapantharim ashkarim yidag lahem. We will worry about them. So basically, all these unwanted hooligan teenagers from the projects who themselves at 18 fought the Yom Kippur War and fought bravely, they're going to come back home to Israel like the Vietnam veterans coming back to America. And what's going to happen to them? Who's going to look after them? They weren't wanted before the war. You're going to want them now? We'll look after them. So this is a great political ad because it attracts the attention, and they almost won a Knesset seat. They won 0.9% of the vote, which is not much, but nothing to sneeze at for a new party, which is a sectoral party and an ethnic party. They almost won a seat. All right? Almost, but almost doesn't count. All right. Then, there's one more party to mention, and that is Moked, which was the Blue-Green Alliance, the Blue-Red Alliance. It was basically an anti-Zionist, environmentalist party of Jews who were not necessarily out-and-out communists, but were dissatisfied with 1973 Israel and wanted a pristine environment, no more war, basically pie-in-the-sky socialists / environmentalist wackos. They won one seat. Okay. All right. Now, in the few minutes we have left, what was the end result of this election? One more political ad, and I couldn't print it, so I'll have to look at my phone. Copied it. Where are we? Okay. Ephraim Kishon, the great satirist, had an ad where on the one side you have Golda Meir, on the other side Menachem Begin, each one holding up a sign. And the signs are almost identical. Golda's sign says, Bechol Zot Ma'arach. Despite all of what happened, vote for the Ma'arach. And what does Begin's sign said? Ma'arach. B'chol zot? Well, after all that happened, you're going to vote for the Ma'arach? Okay, so the same words, but just change the order, put the comma in a different place, and you get the two points of view. So there was a real concern that there would be blank ballots, a protest vote, of no vote at all. And the question is, who benefits from the blank ballot? Well, it all depends upon who you ask. Because from everyone will claim a blank ballot is a vote for the other guy, on the premise that really everyone should be voting for me. If you don't vote for me, if you vote blank, it's like the other guy got an advantage. So the Labour Party was running ads the last week before the election, between December 25th and December 31st, saying, don't do a protest vote of a blank ballot. If you do, the Likud will win. You have to actually put the slip of paper with the emet, Aleph Mem Taf, for the alignment. Otherwise, we were in danger of losing. And the Likud argued the other way around. No, a blank ballot is a big mistake. Because what are you really trying to do? You're trying to oust the old regime. And you're not going to oust them unless you vote for somebody other than the old regime. You have to actually put on the piece of paper the letters for Likud. Okay? So that's what each side is claiming. What are the end results? So the alignment won 51 seats. 51 seats was a decline of 5. So is that good or bad, 51? Well, they won. I mean, nobody else got as much. But from a perspective of their past record, is this decent enough?
Depends who jumps in bed with them.
Okay, good. It all depends upon who wins the other seats and who's willing to join a coalition with them. 51 is only 9 away from half, but those 9 might be hard to come by. The Likud wins 39. It's an increase of 7 over the constituent elements that made up the Likud from the previous cycle. The National Religious Party won 10, which was down 2. Why did they go down 2? In part, maybe because Kahana siphoned away some votes. The Haredim won 5, which was a decline of 1. The Independent Liberals won 4, which was breaking even. Raqqa, which is the Arab Communists, won 4, which was an increase of 1. Ratz, which was Shulamit Aloni's Citizens' Rights Party, won 3. They were a brand new party. Why did she form a party? She broke away from the alignment because she hated Golda Meir. The two women didn't get along. Each one accused the other of being insufficiently female. And it got very personal with the two of them. The Arabs had 2 parties, 1-2 seats and another with 1 seat, so combined for 3 seats. And these were the satellite Mapai parties of old. This will be the last election in which they win anything. And Moked, which was the Jewish socialist environmentalist types, won 1 seat. Now, if you notice, there are only 10 parties in the Knesset. 10 might sound like a lot, but actually it isn't. Because earlier go-rounds of the Knesset elections, there were more than 10. In fact, what do you see here? That 90 out of 120 seats are in the hands of 2 parties. And 100 out of 120 seats are in the hands of 3 parties. So really, after you get below the NRP, you get it past the top 3, it's really a pittance. They're trading in almost nothing. With that in mind, the Labor has a job on its hands. Because how do you form a coalition? There was going to be pressure put on the alignment for a national unity government with the Likud. However, Golda Meir would not do that. She rejected that out of hand, saying that it would be a government by paralysis. Nothing would be accomplished. Was she right to assume that? Well, I think the answer is yes. After all, between 1967 and 1970, when there was a national unity government, there was paralysis on the diplomatic front, and there only was any step forward with the second Rogers plan when the Gachal left, and Begin left the cabinet and went to the opposition. When else do we find in Israeli history national unity government leads to diplomatic paralysis? In the 1980s. 1984 to 1990 was a 6-year national unity government, because things were too tight in the elections. It was almost a tie. And what happened? Nothing. No peace with the Arabs. The London Agreement of 1987 with Shimon Peres and King Hussein was scuttled by Yitzhak Shamir. So when you have a national unity, the left side is going to push for peace, the right side is going to oppose, and in the end, nothing gets done. So that national unity was not a likely outcome of this election, although it would have been a lot easier to form a cabinet that way. As I said, the NRP is now territorially maximalist, which is not going to go over well with the alignment that has a significant number of doves and is promising peaceful negotiations with the Arab world. So who is left for the Labour alignment to talk to? They have the Independent Liberals, which gets them to 58 seats because you have the 3 Arabs which are thrown in too. So 58 is not enough. 58 is not enough. Throughout the early months of 1974, and next week we'll talk about this at length, Golda is really struggling. How do you form a cabinet? The other question is, even within the alignment, who's there? Who should be in the cabinet? Who should even be in the Knesset? Before the election, there were those who said, let's postpone the elections and change the slate of candidates to include more dovish voices. that the alignment was too hawkish. Too hawkish. Who was so hawkish in the alignment? Well, Shimon Peres, Moshe Dayan, the whole Rafi branch. But that didn't win out. Ultimately, there's a question about whether Golda should be the prime ministerial candidate. And on December 5th, she won by a wide margin to become the prime ministerial candidate. So she's in. Dayan is in. But there is tumult. People want them out. They say, you blundered, you have to leave. But the alignment won. So it's a very odd situation where a party that was despised, its leadership was despised, just won a parliamentary election. So how do you reconcile the two? Well, the answer is maybe you can't. And in short order, they'd have to go. So we'll stop here. What we'll do next time is to examine what does the Agronaut report say? How did the various political officials respond to them either being criticized or not criticized? What is the public reaction? And who replaces those who are ousted? There's going to be a big fight to replace the old generation, the old guard. New people, young people, relatively speaking, are going to want to step in. See you next week.